Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 20, 2019. A new human rights report implicates South Sudanese defense forces and rebels of committing atrocities amounting to war crimes.
The situation in the Equatorial remains extremely volatile. We continue to conclude in our report that there have been human rights violations, including, again, rape and sexual violence, and we consider that those crimes could amount to war crimes.
And South Sudan government is begging businessmen and women to support the implementation of the peace deal.
The results we expect is that there must be peace in South Sudan. It doesn't matter how much we contribute, because most of my colleagues have contributed a lot just for peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A UN fact-finding mission in South Sudan has uncovered evidence of violence and gross violations of human rights that may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The report by a three-member UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council on March 12. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report covers the human rights situation in South Sudan in 2018, but Commission member Andrew Clapham says it is not possible to ignore the more recent atrocities occurring in the country. He says the Commission is particularly upset by reports of renewed fighting in the Yei River area in central Equatoria between the government and rebel National Salvation Front. He says thousands of civilians have been forcibly displaced following what he calls a scorched earth policy. He says the warring parties reportedly are attacking villages, torching homes, killing civilians, and raping women and girls.
With regards to the rest of the country, I suppose we are a little more hopeful. Following the signing of the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict 5 months ago, but the situation in the Equatorias remains extremely volatile. We continue to conclude in our report that there have been human rights violations, including, again, rape and sexual violence, and we consider that those crimes could amount to war crimes.
Cases of rapes documented in November and December show a marked worsening of sexual violence in several South Sudanese states since the peace accord was signed. Clapham says the commission also has received reports of sexual violence against men and boys, but notes these crimes are underreported compared to those against women and girls because there is a greater level of stigma. The report finds that rights violations, including torture, arbitrary arrests, abductions, and sexual slavery, have become commonplace in South Sudan because nobody is held accountable. The commissioners warn that as long as impunity remains the norm, these atrocities and the violence that feeds upon them will continue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reactions are mixed from South Sudan's warring parties on the new UN human rights reports, in which investigators say they have found evidence of ongoing violations in the country that may constitute war crimes. Walter Onen Solomon has more for VOA from Juba.
The report released documents horrific human rights abuses. Colonel Lampol Gabriel, the SPLAIO's deputy military spokesman, refuses to say whether his group committed human rights violations against civilians. He says the SPLAIO is investigating the alleged human rights abuses on its own and will punish anyone found guilty of committing such violations.
There's a committee being set by our chairman to investigate those alleged incidents that took place. In case we find anyone responsible for these atrocities, he or she will be held responsible immediately.
Lamb says he sees no need for the UN rights body to release such a report at a time when South Sudan's peace partners are busy implementing the revitalized peace deal.
some suspicion as to whether the human rights or the UN really they have advisory role or they don't have. Or we talk in the same language of peace in this country, or all they want is to report negative things. So renewal of investigation is like saying we have failed in our first investigation.
Major General Lul Roy Kong, spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, says he is yet to see the report, but doubts it contains anything new.
I think it's the same old wine, which is just put in a new bottle. The same thing they have been talking about, A, B, C, D, E, but when we get down to ground, we normally find all the accusations to be untrue. We just had a report list, and the government formed its own investigation committee. They went on the ground. They tried to correlate what was released with what was the reality on the ground, and it was discovered that it was just a pile of lies.
Still, Gabriel says his group will ensure that any of its soldiers found guilty of the alleged atrocities will be held accountable.
Whoever is responsible for doing anything wrong, if he is brought up and is found guilty, yes, he can be judged by the court and he can be indicted. If he has to be indicted, we cannot go against the law.
The UN Human Rights Investigating Body says despite mounting evidence, the South Sudanese government has taken no real steps towards accountability. And the reports say South Sudanese leaders have made no progress on the long-promised hybrid court for South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
The Swedish government has donated $13 million to the United Nations Population Fund in South Sudan to improve sexual and reproductive health services in the country. The head of the UNFPA in South Sudan says her agency is determined to reduce the number of preventable maternal deaths in the country. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Hans-Henry Lundqvist, the Swedish ambassador to Juba, and Mary Otieno, UNFPA's country representative in South Sudan, signed a memorandum of understanding in Juba today, pledging to work together to improve maternal, infant, and reproductive health in South Sudan. Ambassador Lundqvist says the money his country donated will be used to provide services to South Sudan's most vulnerable.
The support, as mentioned, is focusing on not at least women and girls and boys to have access to information and services on maternal health and family planning. And we need to really focus on the youth to be able to have informed decisions on their sexual and reproductive health and rights. As I understand, 74% of the population is under 30 in South Sudan. But I'm also concerned about many cases of sexual-based violence in the country, and this must be prevented.
UNFPA country representative Otieno says Sweden's donation will be used to improve access to maternal and infant care, family planning, health services, and prevention of gender-based violence in the country over the next 3 years.
It's more importantly, it's significant because it's an earmarked. And it is not based on project financing, but program-wide support. So it will allow us to work on youth, it will allow us to work on gender-based violence, to work on data, and really have an integrated and comprehensive approach to our programming.
Wilfredo Chan, UNFPA's deputy country representative in South Sudan, says his agency's data shows that nearly 3,000 people seek services after suffering from gender-based violence each year. 97% of the services are used by women. Otan says the need for maternal and infant care in South Sudan remains high.
The humanitarian context of about 4 million people displaced and then maybe 2 million out, about 1.9 displaced internally, 7 million in need, and of that, of the 7 million, we know maybe about 380,000 will be pregnant in the year, they need maternity care. So all those kind of set the pace for us to develop the third country program with the government and the civil society partners and development partners.
Ochan says UNFPA will roll out maternity care services in Wau, Awil, Warap, Bentiu and Malakal with the donated funds. He says many South Sudanese girls who are married off at an early age usually get pregnant early on in the marriage. He says girls could use family planning advice on how to space out their children or delay births, but very few South Sudanese use family planning services. Ochan says many women opt to use traditional family planning methods, which have a high chance of failure compared to modern family planning methods.
We have maternal mortality ratio at 789 per 100,000 live births, which translates to about 11 maternal deaths per day in South Sudan. That's almost a taxi full of women dying due to birth and related pregnancy and birth-related complications.
The fertility rate in South Sudan is also very high, according to Ochan. A new report by the British charity Oxfam warns that another generation of girls in South Sudan will miss out on education, face huge health risks in childbirth, and are more likely to face sexual and domestic violence if efforts to end child and forced marriages are not stepped up. Lundquist says he hopes the government will commit to ensuring sustainability and implementation of reproductive health care programs in South Sudan. In the last 3 years, Sweden donated $10 million to train more midwives in the country. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The South Sudan government is begging businessmen and women in Juba to fund the implementation of the Revitalized Peace Agreement. Officials from the Pre-Transitional Committee, the body overseeing the implementation of the deal, met with business owners in Juba today to convince them to help finance the implementation of the deal. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
The National Pre-Transitional Committee is soliciting for funds from local and foreign businessmen and women in order to fund its activities for the remainder of the 8 months pre-transitional period. Speaking in Arabic at the fundraising campaign event dubbed Make the Impossible Possible, Together We Make Peace Attractive in South Sudan, Information Minister Michael McCoy said asking business people for help is a last resort in the government's efforts to raise the funds needed for implementing the deal.
If this peace is implemented, it will bring a lot of things like improvement in the economy. And what spoiled the economy is because there was war. And if it is war that has spoiled our economy, we have negotiated the peace and remaining its implementation. And I wish all of us could put our hands together so that there is a sustainable peace.
The NPTC says it needs $285 million or 44 billion South Sudanese pounds to get implement activities for the last 3 months of the pre-transitional period. McQuay says once the deal is implemented, opportunities will expand for more South Sudanese business people.
So that if you go from here to Yei, your car will not again be looted or burned. And if the roads are opened, it means that the business is opened and we cannot do this if we do not implement the peace agreement. That's why we are saying, please give us little you have so that we can go ahead to implement this peace deal.
McQuay admits that implementation has been challenging due in part to a lack of funds, but he says the next phase of putting the peace deal into action should be easier. At today's event, businessmen and women pledged more than 500 million South Sudanese pounds and another $500,000 for making that a reality. Speaking in Arabic, Ayi Duan Ayi, president of South Sudan Business Employees Federation, says his group is putting up 3 million South Sudanese pounds.
What we have, but we are happy with the initiative because it is only through peace that a businessman can take his goods to all the 32 states, including Abyei, and can also link with the neighboring countries to make sure that goods come into this country.
But Ayi warned the government must be serious about implementing the deal in order to restore peace and prevent businesses from collapsing.
I have lost more than anybody here in South Sudan because we had South Sudan Hotel in Malakal, Bentiu and Bor. All was destroyed, even hospitals were destroyed just because there was no peace and stability. But now that there is peace, I think the citizens will get the services they needed.
Speaking in Arabic, Salwa Beking Montuil, deputy chair of the business community in Juba, says business owners expect results.
The results we expect is that there must be peace in South Sudan. It doesn't matter how much we contribute because most of my colleagues have contributed a lot just for peace. This is our happiness because we need peace.
The South Sudan government announced last week it will deduct one day's salary from public servants for the next 4 months to raise money to help fund implementing the peace deal. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at a report of sexual abuse at the Vatican. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your definition of a life well lived?
When you accomplish your set goals. Like, for example, when you say, I must finish university, even if you don't work, as long as you're finished, there is no problem. Even if I die today after finishing.
When someone is living a godly way, focused on achieving his or her own goals, and trying to be morally upright.
Though it's not everybody that actually have a dream, but there are some, this set of people that have a dream and then working towards to achieve that dream.
A life well lived is one where one is able to fulfill his dreams, his aspirations, his goals, all that he wants before he dies.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Survivors of sexual abuse go to Rome this week to tell Pope Francis what they expect should happen at a Vatican meeting on the issue, to be attended by bishops from all over the world. They called for zero tolerance to become part of the doctrine of the Catholic Church. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
The four-day meeting on sexual abuse in the Church opens in the Vatican Synod Hall on Thursday and will be attended by around 200 bishops from all over the world. Pope Francis called the meeting as the abuse crisis continued to undermine the credibility of the Church's hierarchy. Survivors and activists from around 20 countries also gathered in Rome with expectations from this summit. Among them is Peter Isley, who was sexually abused by a priest in the United States when he was a boy.
This is a historic moment. This has taken decades. This has taken centuries to happen. And it's now being recognized, and Pope Francis has clearly recognized it as a global problem.
Isley said the same pattern of deceit, non-transparency, and irresponsibility by church leaders is occurring everywhere. He and other survivors would be making their requests to the one person who, in their eyes, can make the difference with his authority. Survivors said many were filled with hope when he was elected 6 years ago.
He took the name of Francis. That was a tremendous and bold thing to do, to take the name of Francis of Assisi, the most beloved saint of the Catholic Church. Saint Francis is for everybody. He's for the world. And to take that name was saying he's going to do what Saint Francis did. He's going to reform this church.
Survivors want what Pope Francis promised 6 years ago, zero tolerance. And zero tolerance, Isley added, has two dimensions to it. Zero tolerance for any member of the church who has abused and for any who has covered up child sex crimes.
And that's just not going to be a sentiment. That's just not going to be an idea. That's not just going to be a hope. That's going to be written into the universal law of the Roman Catholic Church. It's going to be like an infallible doctrine from now on.
Survivors said that after that has been acknowledged and written into church law, the next steps will be identifying all abusers and removing them from their positions. The final hope is to reach what appears to be the impossible, a post-abuse and cover-up Catholic Church. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
From Rome, we move to Zimbabwe, where Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has issued a chilling warning to lawyers and doctors who assisted victims of deadly crackdown on citizens during the recent stay-home strike last month. Correspondent Adi Gondo gives us more on the story.
Speaking at a so-called thank you rally over the weekend, Mnangagwa vowed his readiness to deploy soldiers again to thwart protesters. The country's main labor body, ZCTU, Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, called the protest last month over a 150% fuel hike. Mnangagwa chillingly vowed to pursue lawyers and doctors whom he claimed were aiding and abetting those at the protest, which turned violent. Here, the president speaks at the weekend rally. Observers say that despite talk of a new path and a break from the past, the Mnangagwa government is nothing new. Kutachapulu, a lawyer and MDC alliance legislator, weighs in on Mnangagwa's threats.
Now, if you look at Robert Mugabe, he also threatened Noe. He said exactly the same words. So this guy is merely rehashing Mugabe's script. Mugabe threatened lawyers all the time. Mugabe blamed everything on lawyers. I mean, you simply have to Google it. When lawyers were threatened and accused of all sorts of sort of things over a sustained period of time.
According to Pulu, the problem with the ZANU-PF-led government is that it lacks a culture of constitutionalism. Pulu maintains that lawyers and doctors are merely performing their professional duties.
To ensure that we have sufficient social safety nets and we have access to legal aid, our constitution talks about access to legal aid, that everybody should have access to legal aid. In Namibia, we saw people who have been tried for treason being assisted by the government, finding them lawyers, many of them from Zimbabwe, to come and represent them. So even a government which is upset at you for treason should provide you with legal aid. This government is totally retrogressive, unprogressive, and certainly is out of its senses and does not understand what it is doing or where it is going. I think it's simply an illustration of shallowness.
Civil society actors such as Dumisani Nkomo of Habakuk Trust assess that the protest action within the country is triggered by deep-seated issues.
It's this paranoia is very worrying because we, as a country, we need to address the underlying reasons why people are protesting instead of looking at the symptoms. It would be very unfortunate if lawyers and doctors are targeted for merely trying to help people. These are professionals, and I'm sure they've got no business in looting shops and so forth, but they are professionals who are trying to help people who are in need. So this is an unfortunate attack on the institution of democracy and on fundamental freedoms and rights.
The Zimbabwe government has blamed last month's violence on the opposition MDC alliance. Citing media and civil society reports, the alliance counters that security forces were leading the charge to loot businesses. The Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission also fingered the security forces as being responsible for the violence in which 13 citizens were shot dead. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
As the Egyptian parliament prepares for changes to the constitution that could allow President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to remain in office for 15 more years and expand his powers, the Civil Democratic Movement, a coalition of 10 political opposition parties, is rejecting the idea. Khalid Dawood, a leading member of the movement and former president of Al-Dastur Liberal Party, spoke with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi about the movement's position and the opposition's effort to challenge the constitutional amendments.
Well, because Egypt has had a long experience with having a one-president system whereby the president never changes except by natural death, assassination, or a popular revolution, we believe that going back to the old system whereby a president stays for life means that we're not having any development in our political system or a shift towards democracy whereby we can hold the president accountable. Besides, the president Sisi himself, he agreed when he ran for president the first time in 2014 that he would only be in that position for 8 years, and we see no emergency or immediate need to amend the constitution that was already approved 5 years ago to allow President Sisi to stay in office up until 2034 in case these amendments gain the approval or when a popular referendum takes place sometime in early May.
Given the weak opposition inside and outside the parliament
and the tight media control and a de facto ban on protests or demonstrations, how would the opposition gain support for its rejection?
Well, we hope to widen that opposition. We believe that many Egyptians are not happy with those certain amendments. Even immediately after those amendments were initially approved by Parliament, as opposition groups, we started a petition asking citizens to sign their names to express their opposition to those amendments. And in a matter of 4 days only, we managed to get nearly 30,000 signatures. Besides, we expect other segments of the population, particularly the judiciary, to also express their dissatisfaction with those amendments, because the amendments are not limited to the fact of extending the presidential terms, but it also tightens the grip of the president over the judiciary, giving him the right to appoint the heads of the major courts in Egypt, namely the Constitutional Court and the Court of Cassation and the Court of Appeals, which I think is a very clear violation of any principle of independence of the judiciary. Also, the president will have the right to appoint a prosecutor general. The president will enjoy tremendous powers that no other president has enjoyed over the past 60 years. But we expect for the first time, perhaps, that the opposition parties are going to call for the Egyptians to go and vote, but in that case, vote no, instead of simply boycotting that voting. And we still have some time. We still have 2 months. We also have the social media, which is the only remaining outlet for people to express themselves freely right now, in light of what you rightly mentioned, the tight control over the official media or the mainstream media, whether private or state-owned. But at least we still have at least 50 million Egyptians who widely and intensely use the social media. So we're hoping and we're aiming to have campaigns over the social media to convince more and more Egyptians to turn out on the day of the supposed referendum and to vote no for those amendments.
That was Khalid Dawood, a leading member of the Civil Democratic Movement, a coalition of 10 political opposition parties in Egypt. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. We apologize for that poor quality audio. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Yela by Salifu Kaiti. We have been listening to Salifu Keita with the song Yala. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.